Hello, and welcome to Encircled, the Halber Pocket Podcast. Episode 11, the 29th of April. The Soviets, though caught off guard by the ferocity of the assault on Halber, reacted quickly, and they attempted to seal the breach and contain the breakout. Meanwhile, the German armoured spearhead, led by the 11th SS Panzer Corps, ploughed on towards the Autobahn west of the town, fighting their way through the massed lines of the 3rd Guards Army occupying the woods. These woods had been crammed full of artillery, with the 1st Guards Artillery Division tasked with the objective of completely obliterating the German breakout forces. 2nd Lieutenant Kurt Schwarz of the 1st Battalion of the Panzer Regiment Brandenburg came through Halber in a group of 4 Panthers. After successfully passing through the town, he turned west for the Autobahn. He recalled the fighting which followed. Suddenly I was whirled around in the turret by a hard blow, hit by a mortar bomb. The gunner and loader bandaged me up in the turret. Shortly afterwards we were hit in the side of the engine space and our Panther burst into flames. I screamed, "Out!" We found cover together in a hollow close to the burning tank. Suddenly, there was a big explosion and the pressure blew the turret off the turret ring. We pressed ourselves down in the hollow and the 7-meter-long gun barrel hit the ground right in front of us. 2nd Lieutenant Ernst Habermann of the same battalion was leading a group of tanks in his armoured personnel carrier. He witnessed the destruction of 2 of the German tanks as they approached the Autobahn. A ferocious fight broke out here. Lieutenant Pettersson's tank was shot up and he was killed. Our APC was rammed by a King Tiger when it reversed while engaged by an anti-tank gun, and we had to continue on foot behind our tanks. I was about to get onto a passing tank when it was hit, and I was wounded in the thigh. After a second hit, only the wounded driver and the radio operator bailed out. We lay down under the shot-up Panther and were tending our wounds, when it suddenly burst into flames and we had to move away. Near the Autobahn, we found 6 dead soldiers, who had been shot in the back of the neck. After a night of intense fighting, by the early hours of the 29th, the lead elements of the 11th SS Panzer Corps had successfully reached the Autobahn, where they were able to open a breach in the Soviet lines and hold it open long enough for the wave of 9th Army survivors to follow through. In the chaos at Halber, the bulk of the 11th SS Panzer Corps and the 5th Corps had managed to get through, but the carnage left in their wake had only made it more difficult for the rest of the 9th Army to follow through after them. And flanking attacks from the Soviets managed to close the gap before the 5th SS Mountain Corps could get through. Trapped once again, the 5th SS Mountain Corps had to bear the brunt of the Soviet artillery, which by now had zeroed in on their position and could decimate them with ease. The 5th SS Mountain Corps was able to break out of the town of Halber, but they couldn't break through the Soviet lines, which had now been re-established to the west of the town. This meant they were unable to re-establish contact with the main breakout force. For the next 2 days, the 5th SS Mountain Corps would continue fighting the Soviets whilst trying repeatedly to break out. And this fighting would pin down a large number of Soviet tanks, infantry units and artillery guns. This sacrificial action provided an important distraction which allowed Busse's main breakout force to continue moving westwards. For in the confusion of the woods, the Soviets were unable to determine which breakout force represented the bulk of the remaining 9th Army. The resistance from the 5th SS Mountain Corps would, however, be crushed by the Soviets over the next few days. With the Soviet attention momentarily focused on the forces still trapped in the Halber area, the main body of Busse's breakout force proceeded their trek westwards, and they assembled themselves at the first rendezvous point at the Forsthaus at Massel. There were notably a lot fewer survivors at the rendezvous point than had set off the previous day, with at least 4,000 to 5,000 soldiers and refugees having died just trying to get through Halber. General Busse had made it, but other key senior leaders such as the Chief of General Staff, General Holtz, and General Kleinheisterkamp of the 11th SS Panzer Corps had not made it. And in fact, after being captured by the Soviets on the 28th, Kleinheisterkamp committed suicide. Rudi Linder, an officer cadet with the 1,241st Grenadier Regiment, described the pitiful scene at the first rendezvous point. "We soon arrived at the 9th Army's assembly point. Here, The extent of the tragedy at Halba quickly became apparent. Many comrades were missing from our unit, the majority of our company of Panzergrenadiers having been killed or wounded. There was no accurate account. We soon noticed that there was no longer a strong overall command. A leaderless mass of soldiers and refugees was wandering through the woods. Military discipline and comradeship had fallen by the wayside. The majority of soldiers of all ranks moved like sheep around and behind the tanks, trying to get on board whenever they stopped. Just as in Halba, hits from anti-tank, artillery and mortar fire, as well as the many air attacks, had a catastrophic effect on soldiers and civilians alike. Each impact cost 10 to 20 times the number of dead and wounded as it would have done under normal combat conditions. At first, the wounded were tended to and the dead laid aside in the woods. But later, especially at night, this ceased. People became more and more numbed. Hunger and fatigue added to this. And only the fear of becoming prisoners of the Russians drove the soldiers on, regardless of casualties. The breakout force couldn't afford to rest, and after a quick ammunition check, they continued on their journey. They kept to the strategy of using the woods for cover, but they still ran into heavy Soviet resistance. The 1st Ukrainian Front's 21st Rifle Corps was engaged in battle in the woods between Dornswalde and Neuendorf, with Busse's forces managing to break the Soviet resistance, causing them to scatter. With this success, the 9th Army Breakout Group had successfully broken through the 2nd Soviet defence line, west of Halba. By the late afternoon of the 29th, the group managed to reach the Zossen-de-Barut road, where they encountered the 3rd key defensive line of the Soviet 3rd Guards Army. Despite a heavy Soviet presence, the German tanks spearheaded the assault on this line, blasting through anti-tank barriers and engaging in fierce tank battles with Soviet T-34s. Helmut Jurisch, a radio operator in the Kurmark Panzergrenadier Division, shared his experience of reaching the Zossen-de-Barut road. Of the 14 Panthers surrounded in the Halba pocket, only 9 survived the 28th of April, including the one in which I served as radio operator. With 3 other Panthers, we crossed the Autobahn unscathed in the night, guided by our guardian angel. And that morning, we reached the railway running alongside Reichstrasse 96 between Wunsdorf and Barut. While we were crossing the railway embankment, there was an explosion inside the tank, and stabbing flames and spraying sparks forced us to bail out. As the Panther rolled back down again, it burst into flames. We picked ourselves up, slightly singed. The other Panthers were engaging the anti-tank barrier that had knocked us out. A trick of fate had spared our lives, for as the tank climbed the embankment, the shell aimed centrally at the front of the tank had passed underneath and exploded against the gearbox located between the driver's and radio operator's seats. The 9th Army survivors later reported that the progress of the German tanks at the Zossen-de-Barut road was hampered by the presence of Seydlitz troops in the area, with one reporting how a German tank commander was tricked into repositioning his tanks away from a critical road junction, leaving the escaping column vulnerable to Soviet flanking attacks. Despite these setbacks, the 9th Army spearhead successfully assaulted the Soviets along the Zossen-de-Barut road, and they created a 2-kilometer-wide breach in their lines. This juncture represented the furthest extent which had been reached by the battlegroups von Luck and Pipkorn during the first breakout attempt. But now, due to the combined effort of the German tanks and the stream of infantry and civilians following behind them, the breakout was able to successfully cross the Zossen-de-Barut road. And by the afternoon of the 29th, the breakout group had reached the second rendezvous point at the Forsthaus Wunder. Yet despite the significance of reaching this important waypoint on their journey, the survivors who had made it this far were still fixated on the presence of Seydlitz troops. SS Grenadier Tag reported on a conference he took part in at the rendezvous point at Forsthaus Wunder. During the conference, an unidentified colonel appeared and broke into the conversation, imploring those standing around to follow him as he knew a safe way out. Then came the word, "Seydlitz man," and some catch questions were asked. There were some shots, and the colonel collapsed. Similar incidents occurred elsewhere, where an NCO and a sergeant were identified as Seydlitz people and shot. We now paid more attention to the uniform. Good, clean uniforms were a clue of Seydlitz people. After a short rest, the breakout force again moved on, aiming for the direction of the third rendezvous point at Krummersdorf Gut. By now, the rapidly diminishing fuel supplies were leading to an increasing number of tanks and vehicles being abandoned on the side of the road or in the forests. And sometimes, these breakdowns were occurring right in the heat of battle. As SS Beermann recounted, "We passed the village of Horstwalde. After a broad meadow valley, the land began to rise. Suddenly, everything stopped. Of all things, the leading Jagdpanzer had run out of fuel at a tree barrier. Then, in this situation, the cry went up, 'Ivan is attacking!' Meanwhile, it had become dark, so who on earth could tell where and who Ivan was? Firing everywhere, we towed the Jagdpanzer back out of the barrier with our SPG, and we siphoned off the last drops of fuel before blowing it up." Despite these setbacks, the desperate breakout group pushed on. The people of the breakout group were displaying superhuman levels of endurance, which is incredible given the fact many of them were wounded and starving. But the single-minded desire to reach the West was pushing the people to do unbelievable things. When Krummersdorf Gut was reached in the middle of the night, for example, mixed groups of German tanks, soldiers, and civilians launched attacks on the defending Soviet forces stationed around the complex. Willy Claire, who lived nearby, described the fighting at the Krummersdorf Gut. "On the evening of Sunday 29th of April, Russian soldiers entered our homes and ordered the inhabitants to go to the cellar of the old folks' home. The Germanskis were coming. The din started at about 2200 hours with bangs and flashes. There were screams, and suddenly there were wounded German soldiers in the cellar. They belonged to General Busse's 9th Army. There were several wounded from explosive bullets among the civilian population, including a 10-year-old, Fritz Feldner, who received a splinter in his thigh that hit the artery. He died from loss of blood within a short time, as there were no doctors available." The fighting continued, but despite the strength of the defences, the tidal wave of German soldiers and armed refugees proved too much for the Soviets to handle. After an intense firefight, the German tanks stormed the military complex and captured it. However, this success brought with it its own problems. For whilst the armoured spearhead had reached Krummersdorf Gut, the rest of the breakout group were struggling to keep pace, as the assortment of injured servicemen and wounded civilians travelling on foot couldn't possibly match the speed of the lead tanks. This meant that by the night of the 29th, the breakout group resembled a caterpillar measuring 2 kilometres wide, stretching from Krummersdorf Gut at the front all the way back to the western outskirts of Halber itself, a distance of roughly 30 kilometres. We shouldn't therefore envision the breakout force as being one homogeneous mass of people, but rather a long, spindly, and fragile group. The consequence of this was that even if the lead German tanks managed to punch through the main Soviet defences and plough on westwards, other Soviet forces positioned on the flanks could still easily counterattack into the massed swarm of German soldiers and refugees following up behind. This would become a recurring theme during the breakout, as any stragglers or body of troops who found themselves losing contact with the protection of the lead German tanks would quickly be surrounded and be either killed or captured by the Soviets. The forces Konev would use to carry out this strategy included the 71st Mechanized Brigade, who targeted the lead German tanks at Krummersdorf Gut, whilst the 50th and 54th Guards Rifle Divisions attacked the flanks of the breakout group. And this dual line of attack threatened to split the breakout group in two. Nevertheless, despite the intensity of the Soviet attacks up and down the escaping column, a small slither of contact was still maintained between the lead group in the area of Krummersdorf Gut and the main body of the breakout force following behind them, who were in the Zesch, Dornswalde and Radeland area. By the evening of the 29th, the soldiers and civilians at the head of the escape group had successfully managed to break through 3 Soviet defence lines, and they had covered approximately 25 kilometres in reaching Krummersdorf Gut. This meant they were more or less halfway to the 12th Army waiting for them in the vicinity of Bielitz. But this success had come at a great cost. By now, all pretense of order and leadership had broken down within the breakout group. Every man, woman and child was on the run, with individuals and small groups fighting tooth and nail to reach the next field, the next woods, or even just the next farmhouse. But despite the losses the Germans were suffering, the Soviets could see that the breakout group was nearing its objective. Konev transferred extra units to the towns of Trebin and Luckenwalde in order to block the path to Bielitz itself, whilst reserve units were thrown at the head, the flanks, and the rear of the breakout group. With these deployments, Konev hoped to achieve two goals. Firstly, that the breakout force would be contained and its lead elements prevented from moving further west. And secondly, that the breakout group could then be encircled once again and destroyed. For our last event of the day, it's time to go back to Wenck and his 12th Army. As on the 29th, Wenck finally let German High Command know that the 12th and 9th Armies were not going to be marching onto Berlin. So Wenck had spent the day integrating the Potsdam garrison into his forces, and the 12th Army had consolidated the lines which it held. But in truth, Wenck's forces had reached their operational limit. They had exerted a huge effort just to reach Fesch, south of Potsdam, and due to an increase in the Soviet counterattacks on their eastern flank, they were barely holding onto the area around Bielitz in anticipation of the arrival of the 9th Army. Wenck radioed General Weidling, commander of the defense forces in Berlin, and informed him that the 12th Army could advance no further. He suggested that Weidling's forces break out of Berlin towards the 12th Army. The signal was not acknowledged, and it's doubtful General Weidling even received it. Wenck contacted OKW on the evening of the 29th, and he gave them his dire appraisal of the situation facing the 12th and 9th Armies. He outlined how the 12th Army, and in particular the 20 Corps, could not advance any further, and they would instead have to concentrate wholly on defensive actions all along its front. Wenck also informed OKW that the 9th Army was no longer an effective fighting force after the losses it had suffered during its various breakout attempts. These two factors made an attack on Berlin impossible. And to make things worse, the Soviet 5th Guards Mechanized Corps and the 13th Army were about to cut off Wenck's line of retreat back to the Elbe. So unless the 12th Army withdrew quickly, they would also face encirclement and annihilation. This message from Wenck seems to have finally broken the spell of delusion at OKW, as Field Marshal Keitel gave a reply later that night which reluctantly acknowledged Wenck's assessment. In the message, Keitel still tried to guilt-trip Wenck by outlining his historical and moral responsibility of saving Berlin, but it ended by saying, "If you consider the attack on Berlin impossible..." Released from any concern regarding his previous orders to save Berlin, Wenck now had a free hand to transfer his entire focus to linking up with the 9th Army, before racing to the Elbe, before the Soviets got there first. Hitler, meanwhile, was still wallowing in his pool of madness. At 11 p.m. on the 29th, he rejected a request by General Weidling that the Berlin garrison be allowed to break out of the city. And he followed up by sending OKW Chief Jodl a list of demands, wanting to know the exact position of Wenck's spearheads and when they would be resuming their attack towards Berlin. Hitler also wanted to know the location of the 9th Army, and he demanded a progress report on their breakout.